to eat copious amounts of red meat, and thus the saturated fat that goes with it. They lost more weight, their triglycerides dropped further, a good thing, their HDL went up further, a good thing, and their blood pressure down further, a good thing, than those on any of the other diets. The fact that the subjects only lost 10 pounds on the Atkins diet is not particularly telling, as these people went back to eating significant carbohydrates as the study progressed. Their weight loss tracks with their carbohydrate consumption. At 3 months, they had lost 9 pounds and were reportedly eating an average of 240 to 250 calories of carbohydrates a day. At 6 months, 12 pounds and 450 calories of carbohydrates. At 12 months, only 10 pounds and 550 calories of carbohydrates. Here's how the Stanford researchers described the results. Many concerns have been expressed that low-carbohydrate weight loss diets, high in total and saturated fat, will adversely affect blood lipid levels and cardiovascular risk. These concerns have not been substantiated in recent weight loss diet trials. The recent trials, like the current study, have consistently reported that triglycerides, HDLC, HDL cholesterol, blood pressure, and measures of insulin resistance either were not significantly different or were more favorable for the very low carbohydrate groups. The point man on this trial was Christopher Gardner, director of nutrition studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center. Gardner presented the results of the trial in a lecture that's now viewable on YouTube. The Battle of Weight Loss Diets. Is anyone winning at losing? He begins the lecture by acknowledging that he's been a vegetarian for 25 years. He did the study, he explains, because he was concerned that a diet like the Atkins diet, rich in meat and saturated fat, could be dangerous. When he described the triumph of the very low-carbohydrate, meat-rich Atkins diet, he called it a bitter pill to swallow. The bad cholesterol problem. Updating the LDL connection. These clinical trials alone should put your mind to rest about the idea that eating high-fat or high-saturated fat diets will give you heart disease. But there are a few other factors worth discussing that most of these trials didn't address. The first involves LDL. It speaks again to how the science of heart disease has evolved since the 1970s. When we first started hearing about the evils of LDL, and physicians and health reporters began to refer to LDL as the bad cholesterol, they did so because they thought it was the cholesterol that caused the buildup of plaque in our arteries. LDL, though, actually isn't cholesterol. It's the particle, the low-density lipoprotein, i.e. LDL, that contains the cholesterol and shuttles it and triglycerides around the bloodstream. The bad cholesterol terminology is a problem only because the researchers who study these things now say that it's not the cholesterol carried by the LDL that is to blame for heart disease, but rather the LDL particle itself and other similar particles. The cholesterol seems to be an innocent bystander. To complicate matters, not all LDL particles appear to be equally harmful, or atherogenic, which is the term used by the experts to describe something that causes atherosclerosis, or makes it worse. Some of the LDL in our circulation is large and buoyant, and some is small and dense. There are gradations in between. The small and dense LDL particles appear to be the atherogenic ones, the ones we want to avoid. They work themselves into the walls of our arteries and begin the process of forming plaques. The large, buoyant LDL particles appear to be harmless. This is important because carbohydrate-rich diets not only lower HDL and raise triglycerides, they also make LDL small and dense. These three effects all increase our risk of heart disease. When we eat high-fat diets and avoid carbohydrates, the opposite happens. HDL goes up, triglycerides go down, and the LDL in the circulation becomes larger and fluffier. Individually and together, these changes decrease our risk of having a heart attack. So what appears to be a bad thing, circa 1970 science, the effect of saturated fat on LDL cholesterol, is again a good thing, circa 2010 science, the effect of saturated fat on the LDL particle itself. The health officials hesitate to discuss this science publicly because it contradicts much of what we've been told for the past 30 to 50 years. Occasionally, though, researchers will let the facts break through, as did Chris Gardner and his Stanford colleagues when they wrote up the results of their A to Z study. Their language is on the technical side, but it's not so technical that you shouldn't be able to follow it. Two of the more consistent findings in recent trials of low-carbohydrate versus low-fat diets have been higher LDL cholesterol concentrations and lower triglyceride concentrations in the low-carbohydrate diets. Although a higher LDL cholesterol concentration would appear to be an adverse effect, this may not be the case under these study conditions. The triglyceride-lowering effect of a low-carbohydrate diet leads to an increase in LDL particle size, which is known to decrease atherogenicity. In the current study, at 2 months, mean LDL cholesterol concentrations increased by 2%, and mean triglyceride concentrations decreased by 30% in the Atkins group. These findings are consistent with a beneficial increase in LDL particle size, although LDL particle size was not assessed in our study. These findings may indeed be a bitter pill for some to swallow, but they confirm that the diet we have to eat to lose weight, the one restricted in fattening carbohydrates, is also the diet that will best prevent heart disease. Metabolic syndrome. What I've tried to make clear in this chapter is that the fear of fat, saturated in particular, is based on the state of the science in the 1960s and 1970s, and it simply doesn't hold up in the light of more recent research and the state of the science today. But one more very important point has to be made. Earlier, I discussed what happens when we become what's technically known as insulin resistant, when muscle and liver cells in particular become resistant to the effect of the hormone insulin. Not only do we secrete more insulin in response, and so tend to get fatter, especially around the waist where the fat cells are most sensitive to insulin, but we begin to manifest a host of other related metabolic disturbances as well. Blood pressure goes up, triglycerides go up, HDL cholesterol goes down. What I didn't mention earlier is that LDL particles become small and dense. We become glucose intolerant, which means we have trouble controlling our blood sugar. We might even develop type 2 diabetes, which happens when the pancreas can no longer secrete enough insulin to compensate for the insulin resistance. This combination of heart disease risk factors is now known as metabolic syndrome, and it is, in effect, the intermediate step on the way to heart disease. More than a quarter of the adult population in the United States now suffers from metabolic syndrome, according to the official estimates. And the reason why this number is so high is that metabolic syndrome includes diabetes and obesity among its symptoms, and we're experiencing epidemics of both. As you get fatter, as your waistline expands, you tend to lose control of your blood sugar. You are more likely to get hypertension, atherosclerosis, heart disease, and strokes. All these conditions are associated with the same cluster of what the experts call lipid abnormalities. Low HDL, high triglycerides, and small dense LDL. And all of these are triggered by the insulin resistance and the elevated insulin secretion that accompanies it, by the carbohydrates in our diet, and maybe the sugars, sucrose, and high fructose corn syrup in particular. The science of metabolic syndrome has been evolving since the late 1950s, when researchers first linked carbohydrate consumption to high triglycerides, and then high triglycerides to heart disease. It went virtually unnoticed for decades because the heart disease experts and the nutritionists were focused so obsessively on saturated fat and cholesterol. They didn't see a need to entertain alternative explanations for why we have heart attacks, and so they didn't. The driving force in the science of metabolic syndrome was a Stanford University physician named Gerald Reven, who recognized early that excessive insulin secretion and insulin resistance are the root causes of this entire suite of metabolic disturbances. When the authorities began paying attention to Reven's work in the mid-1980s, they had trouble embracing it, because his research implicated carbohydrates, not fat, as the dietary causes of both heart disease and diabetes. Anyone who consumes more carbohydrates has to dispose of the load by secreting more insulin, as Reven explained at a National Institutes of Health diabetes conference in 1986. Then he presented the evidence linking insulin to heart disease. The chair of the conference, Harvard's George Cahill, said Reven's results speak for themselves, which they did. But that was the problem. "Sometimes we wish it would go away, because nobody knows how to deal with it," said one NIH administrator of Reven's work. Today, the science of metabolic syndrome represents probably the single greatest advance of the last half century in our understanding of what causes heart disease and its intimate association with hypertension, obesity, and diabetes. It explains why those three conditions all increase dramatically our risk of heart disease, and why, if we have one of these conditions, we're likely to have the others as well. What metabolic syndrome tells us is that heart disease and diabetes are not caused by individual risk factors. Low HDL, for instance, or high triglycerides, or small dense LDL, but by insulin resistance and elevated levels of insulin and blood sugar playing havoc with cells everywhere. The insulin works on the fat cells to make us accumulate fat, and the expanding fat cells then release what are called inflammatory molecules, cytokines in the technical lingo, that have adverse effects throughout the body. It works on the liver to convert carbohydrates into fat, and this fat, triglycerides, is sent off into the bloodstream on the particles that eventually become small, dense LDL. It works on the kidney to raise blood pressure by reabsorbing sodium, and so has the same effect as eating extreme amounts of salt, and by impairing the secretion of uric acid, which also accumulates to unhealthy levels in the bloodstream. High uric acid levels cause gout, which is also associated with obesity and diabetes, and the incidence of gout, too, is increasing in Western societies. The insulin also works on the artery walls to stiffen them and cause the accumulation of triglycerides and cholesterol in the budding atherosclerotic plaques. While this is happening, the chronically elevated blood sugar level that goes along with insulin resistance creates a host of problems on its own. It causes oxidative stress throughout the body. The reason we're always told to consume foods rich with antioxidants is to combat or prevent this oxidative stress. And it leads to the creation of advanced glycation end products, which seem to cause everything from the stiffening of our arteries to the aging of our skin and the premature aging that is part and parcel of diabetes. To diagnose metabolic syndrome, doctors are told to look first for an expanding waistline because metabolic syndrome is so closely tied to obesity. And because saying someone has metabolic syndrome is equivalent to saying someone is insulin resistant, the experts blame both conditions on sedentary behavior and overeating. Why? Because they believe overeating and sedentary behavior make people fat. They then offer the familiar advice about low-fat diets, because they worry about the increased risk of heart disease that accompanies metabolic syndrome, and about eating less and exercising, because they think these are required for weight loss. Here a little common sense is in order. As Reven said a quarter century ago, it's the carbohydrates that drive up insulin levels. We now know that carbohydrates make us fat, and it's been demonstrated in numerous clinical trials that low-carbohydrate, high-fat diets improve each and every one of the metabolic and hormonal abnormalities of metabolic syndrome. The low HDL, the high triglycerides, the small dense LDL, the high blood pressure, and the insulin resistance and chronically elevated levels of insulin. This suggests the obvious, that the same carbohydrates that make us fat are the ones that cause metabolic syndrome. And it tells us that the best and perhaps only way to treat the condition, as with obesity and overweight, is to avoid carbohydrate-rich foods, particularly the ones we digest easily, and sugars. Metabolic Syndrome Redux. Just a few more points need to be made about the importance of understanding the relationship between carbohydrates and metabolic syndrome. As it turns out, both Alzheimer's disease and most cancers, including breast cancer and colon cancer, are associated with metabolic syndrome, obesity, and diabetes. This means that the fatter we are, the more likely we are to get cancer, and the more likely we are to become demented as we age. David Schubert and Pamela Marr, neurobiologists at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in San Diego, recently described the association with Alzheimer's this way. There is a cluster of risk factors for type 2 diabetes and vascular disease that include high blood glucose, obesity, high blood pressure, increased blood triglycerides, and insulin resistance. All of these factors, both individually and collectively, increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Researchers have begun to work out mechanisms through which insulin and high blood sugar might cause the brain deterioration symptomatic of Alzheimer's. Some researchers have even taken to referring to Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes, and how high blood sugar, insulin, and the related hormone insulin-like growth factor spur tumor growth and cause tumors to metastasize. The link between cancer and metabolic syndrome is sufficiently well accepted that public health recommendations have already been made based on this research. In 2007, the World Cancer Research Fund and the American Institute of Cancer Research jointly published a 500-page report entitled Food, Nutrition, Physical Activity, and the Prevention of Cancer. The report, co-authored by 24 experts, discussed the evidence linking diet to cancer, and found that the most convincing link ran from diet through greater body fatness to cancers of the colorectum, esophagus, adenocarcinoma, pancreas, kidney and breast post-menopause, and probably gallbladder cancer as well. The report then provided recommendations on how we might remain cancer-free. The first is to be as lean as possible, and to avoid weight gain and increased waist circumference through adulthood. The second recommendation is to be physically active as part of everyday life, because the experts who wrote this report believe that physical activity protects against weight gain, overweight, and obesity, and by doing so protects against cancer. And the third recommendation is to limit consumption of energy-dense foods and avoid sugary drinks, because this is also thought to prevent and control weight gain, overweight, and obesity. The first recommendation is now virtually indisputable. If you're lean, you will be less likely to get cancer than if you're obese. Although this does not mean that body fatness causes cancers, as the report says. The second and third recommendations are based on the belief that we get fat because we consume more calories than we expend. If the expert authors of the report had paid attention to the science of fat accumulation to Adiposity 101, nowhere to be found in the report's 500 pages, they would have concluded the obvious, that the same carbohydrates that make us fat are the ones that ultimately cause these cancers. The simplest way to look at all these associations between obesity, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cancer, and Alzheimer's, not to mention the other conditions that also associate with obesity and diabetes, such as gout, asthma, and fatty liver disease, is that what makes us fat, the quality and quantity of carbohydrates we consume, also makes us sick. Chapter 19. Following Through. This is not a diet book, because it's not a diet we're discussing. Once you accept the fact that carbohydrates, not overeating or sedentary life, will make you fat, then the idea of going on a diet to lose weight, or what the health experts would call a dietary treatment for obesity, no longer holds any real meaning. Now the only subjects worth discussing are how to best avoid the carbohydrates responsible, the refined grains, the starches, and the sugars, and what else we might do to maximize the benefits to our health. Since the 1950s, some very thoughtful diet books have advocated that we restrict carbohydrates to control our weight, and these books have been appearing ever more frequently in recent years. Initially, the authors were physicians, typically with weight problems themselves. This made their experiences similar. They failed to lose weight by eating less or exercising, but eventually came upon the idea of restricting carbohydrates. They tried it, found that it worked, and prescribed it to their patients. Then they wrote books based on their experiences, both to get the message out and also to profit from whatever they considered their personal contribution to the genre. The books sold at first because the regimens worked and because there are always people who will try any new diet if they think it might work. Eat Fat and Grow Slim, 1958. Calories Don't Count, 1960. Dr. Atkins' Diet Revolution, 1972. The Carbohydrate Addict's Diet, 1993. Protein Power, 1996. And Sugar Busters, 1998. Are all best-selling variations on the same theme. Refined carbohydrates, starchy vegetables, and sugars are fattening. Don't eat them. Don't drink them. The South Beach Diet, 2003, is another best-selling variation on this theme, but with the emphasis on lean meats and fats from vegetable sources, olive and canola oil, avocados and nuts, for instance, rather than animal. In the one clinical trial of this diet, weight loss, as expected, rivaled the Atkins-like diets, but not the beneficial results for heart disease and diabetes risk factors. These books are worth reading for the guidance they offer. But the diets themselves, no matter how they vary in the details or the author's understanding of the underlying science, fundamentally work because they restrict fattening carbohydrates. In the appendix, I have given a pared-down version of the kind of dietary guidelines that can be found in many books that would be classified as low-carbohydrate diets in bookstores or on websites. My directives are borrowed from the Lifestyle Medicine Clinic at the Duke University Medical Center, which in turn adapted them from the Atkins Center for Complementary Medicine. The clinic is run by Eric Westman, a physician who became intrigued by the diet in 1998 after one of his patients lost 20 pounds in 2 months and insisted he did so by eating large quantities of steak and little else. Westman responded by reading up on the Atkins diet, meeting with its author, Robert Atkins, in New York, and asking Atkins to fund a small pilot study, 50 patients, 6 months, to determine whether the diet works and is safe. The results confirmed that patients could lose weight and improve their cholesterol profiles on diets of virtually nothing but meat and leafy green vegetables. Westman then visited physicians who were already using Atkins's diet in their clinics: Mary Vernon in Lawrence, Kansas; Richard Bernstein in Mamaroneck, New York; Joseph Hickey in Hilton Head, South Carolina; and Ron Rosedale in Boulder, Colorado, and reviewed their charts to verify that what Atkins was saying, and Westman's pilot study had concluded, actually held up in clinical practice. In 2001, Westman began treating overweight and obese patients with the diet, and he's done so ever since. He has also continued to run clinical trials that have so far confirmed the health benefits of the diet, both in diabetics and in those without diabetes. Westman is also an author, along with Stephen Finney of the University of California, Davis, and Jeff Volek of the University of Connecticut, of the 2010 version of the Atkins diet book, The New Atkins for a New You. The guidelines that Westman distributes to his patients are more detailed, but otherwise little different from the guidance offered by hospitals to their overweight and obese patients in the late 1940s and 1950s. Eat as much as you like of meat, fish, fowl, eggs, and leafy green vegetables. Avoid starches, grains, and sugars, and anything made from them, including bread, sweets, juices, sodas. And learn for yourself whether and how much fruit and non-starchy vegetables, such as peas, artichokes, and cucumbers, your body can tolerate. If these concepts are familiar ones and the details are unnecessary, then I recommend taking the Diet for Obesity from Raymond Green's 1951 endocrinology textbook, The Practice of Endocrinology, which I present on page 155 and 156, and taping it to your refrigerator to refer to as necessary. If you need more details about which foods are acceptable and which are not, then the appendix is the better choice. It would be nice if we could improve on the list of foods to eat, foods to avoid, and foods to eat in moderation. Unfortunately, this can't be done without guessing. The kind of long-term clinical trials have not been undertaken that would tell us more about what constitutes the healthiest variation of a diet in which the fattening carbohydrates have already been removed. We know from clinical trials that carbohydrate-restricted, eat-as-much-as-you-like diets work, and that they have the expected beneficial effects on metabolic syndrome and thus our risk of heart disease. But that's the extent of the reliable knowledge so far. What we have instead as a guide is the science itself, Adiposity 101, and the clinical experience of physicians like Westman who have had enough faith in their own observations and their understanding of the science to wean their overweight, obese, and diabetic patients off fattening carbohydrates, despite having to go against established convention to do so. From the experience of these physicians, Mary Vernon, Stephen Finney, Jay Wortman of the University of British Columbia, and Michael and Mary Dan Eades, authors of Protein Power, I can offer a few thoughts on some of the obvious questions that are raised when we consider trading off fattening carbohydrates for a healthier and leaner life. Moderation or renounce them entirely. Part 1. The fewer carbohydrates we consume, the leaner we will be. This is clear. But there's no guarantee that the leanest we can be will ever be as lean as we'd like. This is a reality to be faced. As I discussed, there are genetic variations in fatness and leanness that are independent of diet. Multiple hormones and enzymes affect our fat accumulation, and insulin happens to be the one hormone that we can consciously control through our dietary choices. Minimizing the carbohydrates we consume and eliminating sugars will lower our insulin levels as low as is safe, but it won't necessarily undo the effects of other hormones, the restraining effect of estrogen that's lost as women pass through menopause, for instance, or of testosterone as men age. And it might not ultimately reverse all the damage done by a lifetime of eating carbohydrate and sugar-rich foods. This means that there's no one-size-fits-all prescription for the quantity of carbohydrates we can eat and still lose fat or remain lean. For some, staying lean or getting back to being lean might be a matter of merely avoiding sugars and eating the other carbohydrates in the diet, even the fattening ones, in moderation. Pasta dinners once a week, say, instead of every other day. For others, moderation in carbohydrate consumption might not be sufficient, and far stricter adherence is necessary. And for some, weight will be lost only on a diet of virtually zero carbohydrates, and even this may not be sufficient to eliminate all our accumulated fat, or even most of it. Whichever group you fall into, though, if you're not actively losing fat and yet want to be leaner still, the only viable option, short of surgery or the prospect that the pharmaceutical industry will come through with a safe and effective anti-obesity pill, is to eat still fewer carbohydrates, identify and avoid other foods that might stimulate significant insulin secretion, diet sodas, dairy products, cream for instance, coffee and nuts among others, and have more patience. Anecdotal evidence suggests that occasional or intermittent fasting for 18 or 24 hours might work to break through these plateaus of weight loss, but this too has not been adequately tested. Physicians who have treated patients by prescribing carbohydrate-restricted diets for a decade or longer and published discussions of their clinical experiences, the British physician Robert Kemp, for instance, who began doing so in 1956, and Wolfgang Lutz, an Austrian physician who began a year later, have reported that a small proportion of their obese patients failed to lose any significant fat, even though they faithfully avoided fattening carbohydrates, or at least said they did. Women failed more often than men, and older patients more often than younger ones. The more obese the patients, and the longer they had been obese, the more likely they were to remain obese. Kemp discussed his experience in a series of three articles published in the British medical journal Practitioner between 1963 and 1972, by which time he'd treated almost 1,500 obese and overweight patients. Lutz discussed his results in his 1967 book, Leben ohne Brot, Life Without Bread, which was republished in English and revised with the help of Christian Allen, a biochemist, in 2000. However, as Lutz said, this doesn't mean that the carbohydrates were not responsible for the disorder, obesity, in the first place. It is quite simply, and sadly, that a point of no return has been reached. What we don't know is whether these individuals could have succeeded had they further restricted carbohydrates, or had they simply had more patience, and maybe both. The conventional logic of diets is that people go on them expecting relatively quick returns in weight loss. By this logic, the dieters are not trying to re-regulate their fat tissue, they're only reducing the calories they consume, with the expectation that their fat cells will willingly respond by giving up the calories they've sequestered. If dieters see no significant losses in a month or two, they decide that the diet has failed and either move to the next one or resign themselves to their adiposity. But the fact is that we are trying to counteract a regulatory disorder of fat metabolism, one that may have been years or decades in the making. Reversing the process might take more than a few months or even a few years as well. Carbohydrate restriction is often equated with eating animals and animal products. The reason is simple. If you eat mostly plants or exclusively plants, you're getting the bulk of your calories from carbohydrates, by definition. This doesn't mean that you can't become lean or remain lean by giving up sugars, flour, and starchy vegetables, and living exclusively on leafy green vegetables, whole grains, and pulses, beans. But it is unlikely to work for many of us, if not most. Leafy green vegetables and pulses have the advantage that the carbohydrates they contain aren't digested quickly. They have what nutritionists call a low glycemic index. But if you're relying on these foods for the bulk of your diet, then the total amount of carbohydrates you're consuming, the glycemic load of your diet, will still be high. This may be enough either to make you fat or to keep you fat. If you try to eat fewer carbohydrates by eating smaller portions, you'll be hungry, with all the problems that entails. So if you are a vegan or a vegetarian, you can still benefit from an understanding of Adiposity 101. You can always improve the quality of the carbohydrates you eat, even if you don't reduce the total quantity. This change alone will assuredly improve your health, even if it's not sufficient to make you lean. Moderation or renounce them entirely. Part 2. Over the years, the physicians promoting carbohydrate restriction have typically taken one of three approaches to maximizing the effect and the sustainability, equally important, of this manner of eating. One is to establish an ideal amount of carbohydrates that you can and perhaps should eat. Say the 72 grams a day, or nearly 300 calories worth, that Wolfgang Lutz prescribes. This is intended to minimize any potential side effects that might occur when the body makes the transition from burning primarily carbohydrates for fuel to burning fat. The approach also assumes that it's easier to eat some fattening carbohydrates than it is to eliminate them entirely. With this logic, Lutz allows small amounts of sugar and an occasional dessert, some crumbs for breaded food, a little lactose in milk, and small quantities of carbohydrate in vegetables and fruit. This may work for some of us, but not for all. Another approach is to aim for minimal carbohydrates from the outset. You don't need them in your diet, so this logic goes, and any short-term side effects you might experience while your body adjusts to a nearly carbohydrate-free diet can be managed. More on that. A third option is a compromise that was pioneered by Robert Atkins 40 years ago. It was based on what seems like an obvious point to make, although not so obvious that the health experts today tend to make it. You enter into a weight loss diet with the singular purpose of becoming as lean as you safely can be. And so all other gustatory desires should be put on hold temporarily until that goal is achieved. When you have achieved your goal and the excess fat has been lost, you can decide if you feel the need to incorporate back into your diet some of the foods you've been avoiding. Diets that operate on this philosophy typically begin with what Atkins called an induction phase, which allows effectively no carbohydrates, fewer than 20 grams a day in Atkins's diet. This has the effect of accelerating initial weight loss and providing encouragement to stick with the diet. You're instructed to give up all carbohydrates, with the sole exception of a few small portions of leafy green vegetables each day. Once your body is actively engaged in burning its own fat stores and you're losing weight at an acceptable pace, a minimal amount of carbohydrates can be added back into the diet. If, however, you stop losing fat, that means your body can't tolerate these carbohydrates and you can't eat them. The same approach can be used once an ideal weight is reached. Add back whatever carbohydrate-rich foods you particularly miss and see how your body responds. If you begin to gain weight, say because you're now eating an apple a day and you don't want to be any heavier, then don't eat the apple. If you don't gain weight, that means your body can tolerate an apple a day. And you can experiment with other carbohydrates. You can see what happens when you also eat an orange a day or a pasta dinner once a week or the occasional dessert. This allows you to determine what your body can tolerate and how much fat you're willing to accommodate for the foods you miss. This approach makes sense. But one other factor has to be taken into account. Allowing some carbohydrates into the diet for some individuals may be like allowing ex-smokers a few cigarettes or reformed alcoholics the occasional drink. In the Carbohydrate Addict's Diet, Rachel and Richard Heller argue, in effect, the exact opposite. That sustained weight loss is best achieved by eating one balanced reward meal a day that includes carbohydrates. This is another concept that may be true and is worth a try, but has never been adequately tested. Some may be able to deal with it. Some may find it is a slippery slope. The occasional dessert on special occasions may become a weekly luxury, then bi-weekly, and finally nightly. And suddenly you've decided that carbohydrate restriction failed as a weight loss regimen because you failed to stick with it and regained the weight. A common argument that many experts wield against carbohydrate restriction is that all diets fail, the reason being that people just don't stay on diets. So why bother? But this argument implicitly assumes that all diets work in the same way. We consume fewer calories than we expend, and thus all fail in the same way. But this isn't true. If a diet requires that you semi-starve yourself, It will fail because, 1, your body adjusts to the caloric deficit by expending less energy, 2, you get hungry and stay hungry, and 3, a product of both of these, you get depressed, irritable, and chronically tired. Eventually, you go back to eating what you always did, or become a binge eater, because you can't abide semi-starvation and its side effects indefinitely. When you restrict fattening carbohydrates, however, you don't have to restrict consciously how much you eat. Indeed, you shouldn't try. You can eat all you want of protein and fat, so you don't get hungry and you don't expend less energy. You might even expend more. The biggest challenge is the craving for carbohydrates. The hunger that accompanies our attempts to eat fewer calories is an unavoidable physiological phenomenon. The craving for carbohydrates is more like an addiction. It is the consequence, at least in part, of insulin resistance and the chronically elevated levels of insulin that go with it, and thus caused by the carbohydrates in the first place. Sugars are a special case. As I discussed earlier, sugar appears to be addictive in the brain in the same way in which cocaine, nicotine, and heroin are. This suggests that the relatively intense cravings for sugar, a sweet tooth, may be explained by the intensity of the dopamine secretion in the brain when we consume sugar. Whether the addiction is in the brain or the body or both, the idea that sugar and other easily digestible carbohydrates are addictive also implies that the addiction can be overcome if you make the effort and have sufficient patience. This is not the case with hunger itself. Avoiding carbohydrates will lower your insulin level. Given time, this should reduce or eliminate the cravings. It could, however, take longer than you'd expect or ideally like. In 1975, the Duke University pediatrician James Sidbury Jr., who would become director that same year of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at the National Institutes of Health, reported great success slimming down obese children on a diet of only 15% carbohydrates. After a year to 18 months, he wrote, the craving for sweets is lost, and the children often pinpointed when this happened to within a specific 1 to 2 week period. If you continue to eat some of the fattening carbohydrates or allow yourself some sugar, or even perhaps artificial sweeteners, though, you may always have the cravings. You may always have what Stephen Finney refers to as intrusive thoughts of food. Anecdotal evidence suggests this is the case, and that's all we have to go on. The implication is that for some, at least, long-term success may be more likely if no compromise is allowed. If you do compromise and eventually return to eating these carbohydrates in quantity, the only reasonable response if weight loss remains your goal will be to try again, just as smokers might try to quit numerous times before they ultimately succeed. There's no other viable option when you find yourself eating fattening carbohydrates again and regaining weight. Try to quit again, or at least cut back to some minimal level. What it means to eat as much as we would like. If you have grown up with one belief system, with one paradigm, as sociologists of science say, it's hard to leave it behind entirely when you open your mind to accept another. We've been told for so long, and believed for so long, that a fundamental requirement for weight loss is that we eat less than we'd like, and for weight maintenance that we eat in moderation, that it's natural to assume the same is true when we restrict the carbohydrates we eat. Eating less of everything, though, as I discussed earlier, is another way of saying that we're going to restrict consciously the amount of protein and fat we consume, as well as the carbohydrates. But protein and fat don't make us fat. Only the carbohydrates do. So there is no reason to curtail them in any way. It's true that people who restrict carbohydrates often eat less than they otherwise might. A common experience is to give up fattening carbohydrates and find that you're not as hungry as you used to be, that mid-morning snacks are no longer necessary. intrusive thoughts of food and the urge to satisfy them vanish. But that's because you're now burning your fat stores for fuel, which you didn't do before. Your fat cells are now working properly as short-term energy buffers, not long-term lockups for the calories they've sequestered. You have an internal supply of fuel that keeps you going throughout the day and night, as it should, and your appetite adjusts accordingly. If you're not running short on fuel, you feel no need to restock every few hours. If you're losing 2 pounds a week, that's 7,000 calories of your own fat that you're burning for fuel every week, 1,000 calories each day that you don't have to eat. Another effect, though, of restricting carbohydrates is that your energy expenditure should increase. You're no longer diverting fuel into your fat tissue, where you can't use it, and so you literally have more energy to burn. By avoiding the fattening carbohydrates, you remove the force that diverts calories into your fat cells. Your body should then find its own balance between energy consumed, appetite and hunger, and energy expended, physical activity and metabolic rate. This process could take time, but it should happen without conscious thought. Trying to rein in appetite consciously could lead to compensatory responses. You might have less energy to burn, so your energy expenditure won't increase, or you hold on to fat that you'd otherwise burn. You might lose lean tissue, muscle, that you might otherwise maintain. And the conscious self-restraint might prompt an urge to binge. Physicians who prescribe carbohydrate restrictions in their clinics say that their patients get the best results when they're reminded or urged to eat whenever they're hungry and until they're satisfied, or even to schedule snacks every few hours and eat whether they are hungry or not. The same argument holds for exercise. There are very good reasons to be physically active, but weight loss, as I discussed earlier, does not appear to be one of them. Exercise will make you hungry, and it's likely to reduce your energy expenditure during times when you're not exercising. The goal is to avoid both of these responses. Trying to drive weight loss by increasing energy expenditure may be not only futile, but also actively counterproductive. You tend to be sedentary when you're overweight or obese because of the partitioning of fuel into your fat tissue that you could be burning for energy. You literally lack the energy to exercise, and so the impulse to do it. Once that problem is fixed, by avoiding the carbohydrates that made you and keep you fat, then you should have the energy to be physically active, and with it, the drive or impulse to do so. The goal is to remove the cause of your excess adiposity, the fattening carbohydrates, and let your body find its own natural equilibrium between energy expenditure and consumption. So you should eat when you're hungry and eat until you're full. If you're not eating carbohydrate-rich foods, you won't get fat or fatter by doing so. Once you start burning your own fat for fuel, you should have the energy to be physically active as well. Fat or protein? Another hangover from the last half century of dietary misguidance is the belief that dietary fat must indeed be bad for us, even if we accept that carbohydrates are causing us to fatten. This is a compromised position that seems perfectly reasonable. It was this kind of thinking in the early 1960s that led proponents of carbohydrate restriction to describe their recommended diets as high in protein instead of high in fat. Rather than avoiding only the fattening carbohydrates, you eliminate butter and cheese from the diet, eat chicken breasts without the skin, lean fish, the leanest cuts of meat, and egg whites without the yolks. As I've said, though, there's no compelling reason to think that fat or saturated fat is harmful, whereas there's good reason to question the benefits of diets that abnormally elevate the protein content. Populations that ate mostly meat or exclusively meat, as I discussed earlier, tried to maximize the fat they ate, and one reason seems to be that high-protein diets, without significant fat or carbohydrates, can be toxic. This issue has been addressed by protein metabolism experts in a recent U.S. Institute of Medicine report called Dietary Reference Intakes. It has been suggested from evidence of the dietary practices of hunter-gatherer populations, both present-day and historical, that humans avoid diets that contain too much protein, the IOM experts explain, citing the same research on hunter-gatherer populations to which I referred. The short-term symptoms of these high-protein, low-fat, low-carbohydrate diets, these protein metabolism experts point out, are weakness, nausea, and diarrhea. These symptoms will disappear when the protein content is reduced to a more moderate 20-25% of calories, and fat content is increased to compensate. When physicians and nutritionists tested carbohydrate restriction before the beginning of the anti-fat movement in the 1960s, they did so with fatty meat and diets that were 75-80% fat by calories, but only 20-25% protein. This mixture had no side effects, was well tolerated, and is most consistent with the diets eaten by populations like the Inuits, who lived almost exclusively, if not exclusively, on animal products. Whether or not a diet that is 75% fat and 25% protein is healthier than one that is 65% fat and 35% protein is an open question. Equally important is the question of which is easier to sustain and provides the most enjoyment. If you find yourself satisfied eating skinless chicken breasts, lean cuts of meat and fish, and egg white omelets, so be it. But eating the fat of the meat as well as the lean, the yolk as well as the white, foods cooked with butter and lard, may be the better prescription for sustainability, and it may be for health as well. On side effects and doctors. When you replace the carbohydrates you eat with fat, you're creating a radical shift in the fuel that your cells will burn for energy. They go from running primarily on carbohydrates, glucose, to running on fat, both your body fat and the fat in your diet. This shift, though, can come with side effects. These can include weakness, fatigue, nausea, dehydration, diarrhea, constipation, a condition known as postural or orthostatic hypotension. If you stand up too quickly, your blood pressure drops precipitously, and you can get dizzy or even pass out, and the exacerbation of pre-existing gout. In the 1970s, the authorities insisted that these potential side effects were reasons why the diets could not generally be used safely, and the implication was that they shouldn't be used at all. But that was to confuse the short-term effects of what can be thought of as a carbohydrate withdrawal with the long-term benefits of overcoming that withdrawal and living a longer, leaner, and healthier life. The more technical term for carbohydrate withdrawal is keto adaptation, because the body is adapting to the state of ketosis that results from eating fewer than 60 or so grams of carbohydrates a day. This reaction is why some who try carbohydrate restriction give it up quickly. The same is true for the occasional elevation of cholesterol that will occur with fat loss, transient hypercholesterolemia, a consequence of the fact that we store cholesterol along with fat in our fat cells. When fatty acids are mobilized, the cholesterol is released as well, and cholesterol levels can spike as a result. The existing evidence suggests that cholesterol levels will return to normal or fall even lower than what they were once the excess fat is lost, regardless of the saturated fat content of the diet. Carbohydrate withdrawal is often interpreted as a need for carbohydrate, says Westman. It's like telling smokers who are trying to quit that their withdrawal symptoms are caused by a need for cigarettes, and then suggesting they go back to smoking to solve the problem. The reason for the side effects now appears to be clear, and physicians who prescribe carbohydrate restriction say they can be treated and prevented. These symptoms have nothing to do with the high fat content of the diet. Rather, they appear to be a consequence of either eating too much protein and too little fat, of attempting strenuous exercise without taking the time to adapt to the diet, or in most cases, of the body's failure to compensate fully for the restriction of carbohydrates and the dramatic lowering of insulin levels that ensues. As I mentioned in passing earlier, insulin signals our kidneys to reabsorb sodium, which in turn causes water retention and raises blood pressure. When insulin levels drop, as they do when we restrict carbohydrates, our kidneys will excrete the sodium they've been retaining and with it water. For most people, this is beneficial, and it's the reason why blood pressure comes down with carbohydrate restriction. This water loss, which can be a half dozen pounds or more in a 200-pounder, can constitute most of the early weight loss. For some individuals, though, the body will perceive the water loss as something to be prevented. It does so through a web of compensatory responses that can lead to water retention and what are called electrolyte imbalances. The kidneys excrete potassium to save sodium, and the result is the side effects just cited. The reaction can be countered, as Finney has noted, by adding sodium back into the diet. Taking a gram or two of sodium a day, a half to one teaspoon of salt, or drinking a couple of cups of chicken or beef broth daily, which is what Westman, Vernon, and other physicians now prescribe. These side effects speak to the importance of having the guidance of a knowledgeable physician when making the decision to avoid fattening carbohydrates. If you happen to be diabetic or hypertensive, then a doctor's guidance is critical, since restricting carbohydrates will lower both blood sugar and blood pressure. If you're already taking drugs to do the same, the combination can be dangerous. Abnormally low blood sugar, known as hypoglycemia, can cause seizures, unconsciousness, and even death. Abnormally low blood pressure, hypotension, can induce dizziness, fainting, and seizures. Doctors who understand why we get fat and what to do about it are obviously hard to find. Otherwise, this book wouldn't be necessary. The truly unfortunate fact is that even those doctors who do understand the reality of weight regulation often hesitate to prescribe carbohydrate restriction to their patients, even if this is how they maintain their own weight. Physicians who tell their fat patients to eat less and exercise more, and particularly to eat the kind of low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet that the authorities recommend, will not be sued for malpractice should any of those patients have a heart attack 2 weeks or even 2 months later. The doctor who goes against established medical convention and prescribes carbohydrate restriction has no such safeguard. As Blake Donaldson said in his 1962 memoirs, no matter how well someone does on the mostly meat diet that Donaldson prescribed, any disaster that may overtake him, even to the extent of ground moles getting in his lawn, will be blamed on his diet. There are now innumerable diet books that preach carbohydrate restriction, not to mention cookbooks and websites devoted to low-carbohydrate eating, and even smartphone apps that can be used for guidance. But it's vital that doctors understand what I've discussed here, that they open their minds to these ideas, and more important, to the hard science that has too often been ignored. This is true of public health officials, too, not to mention the obesity researchers themselves. As long as these authorities buy into the logic of calories in, calories out, and dismiss carbohydrate restriction as a fad diet, we will suffer for it. We need their help, which is why this book was written as much for your doctors as for you. Until our doctors truly understand why we get fat, and until our public health authorities do, the job of losing that fat and remaining healthy will always be far more difficult than it need be. This is Mike Chamberlain. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It by Gary Taubes. This program was produced by Dan Musselman and Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2011 by Gary Taubes. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.